We will call the meeting of the Commerce Committee to order, and our first order of business today is approval of two sets of minutes because somebody forgot to approve a set of minutes last time. We're not, of course, assigning any blame here. We will have Representative Kiefer. Would you be willing to approve the minutes from our first meeting?
Yes, I would. I'll approve them.
Thank you, and we'll do this all as one. And Representative Stensrud, would you be willing to approve the minutes of the second meeting of the Commerce Committee?
I would be excited to approve those minutes.
Thank you very much. All those in favor of approval of the minutes, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Thank you. Things are moving along smoothly. With that, we will move right into our presentation from the Commissioner and Department of Commerce. Gentlemen, take it away whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And welcome, by the way.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity to come before the Commerce Committee and also just to introduce myself to many of the folks here. I've had a chance to work with many of you, but also there's some that are new to me, and I'm hopeful that I can get around to see everybody, meet you, and talk with you. You can always call me, too, if there's an issue or anything that we need to take a look at. We appreciate the opportunity to come over today to give you an overview of the Department of Commerce. I think this is my, how many days have I? Eighth day or something like that. But I'm not new to commerce and have the background both at the legislature and in my practice as an attorney. So, first of all, let me do this. We have some of our managing staff of the department that are with me here today. Manny Munson-Regala is deputy of our Market Assurance, the Enforcement Division. We also have Kevin Murphy. Kevin is the deputy of Financial Institutions. We also have Bill Horlitz, who works with Kevin on examinations. Robert Commodore. Consumer Response. He's also in our Market Assurance area. Paul Hansen is here. Paul is Chief Enforcer. Tim Janke, just trying to pick people out. Tim is our CFO, the CFO of the Commerce Department. And Jackie Gardner. Yes, Jackie. And Jackie is responsible for insurance insolvency and solvency, actually, basically. Not on my watch is her mantra, so mine too.
Well, we like that. Welcome to all of you. Thanks for taking time out of your day to be here today.
All right. Well, with that, let me give you an outline of what the presentation is about. First, we'll talk about the mission of the Department of Commerce and as well some of my own philosophy as I step into the position. Second of all, we'll talk about the organizational structure of the Commerce Department, delve down into the divisions, the four major ones that you see there are Market Assurance, Financial Institutions, and the Energy and Administration Divisions. As I step into the role of Commerce and being the Commissioner, there are really two or three major important goals and aspects of our mission. They start with the executive branch and the responsibility under the Constitution and under the statutes, and to basically regulate the markets, to be able to make sure that consumer protection is a significant aspect of our mission and by taking care of the rights of consumers and individuals. But that said, it's also critical. The Department of Commerce plays a major role in helping businesses succeed, in job creation, and in making sure that there are economic opportunities for businesses in the state of Minnesota. It's a balance, but at the same time, I think that we'll have a terrific working relationship with businesses. And just to give you an idea, when it was first announced on the day that that it was announced that I was going to be the Commerce Commissioner, I picked up the phone and I made a lot of outreach calls. I called folks here, leadership. I talked to, on both sides of the aisle, talked to major bank CEOs, insurance industry CEOs, players in the associations, and as well some of the players in the consumer industry to at least let people know that we're going to have a balanced approach to things. Now, the balanced approach means that on some aspects, we're going to have to be tough on regulation. And that gets into the last point, which is that we're going to be fair and consistent regulators across the board. As I stepped into this role, there were some news stories about things that had taken place prior to me stepping into the role, and I have already been asked a few times, what are you doing about it? I just want to make sure as I start off on the right footing and address some of those concerns immediately, and we'll talk about some of those as we go through the presentation today. Within the Department of Commerce is the Office of Energy Security, which is another major player that we have, and we'll address some of that stuff so that at least you have an understanding. But the overall mission of the Energy Division is to allow access to energy services that are reliable, reasonably priced, and environmentally sound. And within the Energy Division, we have several roles. There's advocating on behalf of the public interest in regulated utility matters, provide heating assistance and energy conservation improvements to income-qualified consumers, and that's largely a lot of federal dollars that flow through the department and that we make sure get into the economy and into people and customers to help them get through the winter. Offering public information on energy use, and that's been a role for years and years and years that the department has had. There are other major pieces to the puzzle as well. The department regulates telephone companies on the state level. It also administers the Telecommunications Access Minnesota program, which is the deaf and hard of hearing program. I spoke to their governing council this week. And it's particularly, at least in my family, a very important program. We manage also the Petro Fund, and we also do the manage the unclaimed property program. And if you have questions on any of these, feel free to stop during the presentation. I'll try and talk.
Thank you, Mr. Commissioner. I'll interrupt at one point. Going back to the unclaimed property, there is a list that the Department of Commerce maintains. And I don't know, sometime last year from the Department of Commerce, we all the members on the committee got that list, and I found, I don't know how much, she didn't tell me, but some unclaimed property for my aunt. So a little bit better Christmas for me from Auntie Eileen. Just to, for advertisement, you can help yourself. Thank you.
It includes securities, too. So, you know, if people are lost and all kinds of stuff. So in any event, let me talk about the Commerce Divisions. We have the Market Assurance Division. Its responsibilities are consumer protection and enforcement. We also have the Financial Institutions Divisions. That's Kevin Murphy's area and as well Jackie Gardner's. Again, that's banking and the insurance solvency and overall maintaining the public interest. Key for me is to make sure that we have the Minnesota banks, make it through this recession, that we have safe and sound banking institutions, not only for the customers and the debtor or the depositors, but also for businesses and our economy as we grow out of this economy or the recession. Next, we also have the Energy and Telecommunications Division. I talked about that a little bit earlier, and then administration as well. Delving down specifically in the first one into the market assurance area, again, it's primary consumer services, enforcement, and licensing arm for the department. It branches out. It's not a particular industry, but it's composed of the following units. So these are sort of the functional areas of the department. There's consumer and industry services. We also have the insurance fraud division. The workers' compensation self-insurance unit, a securities unit within everything, and then the enforcement staff, people that do the examinations, investigations, and all that stuff. Again, those are core functions, but we also regulate many industries, including insurance, securities, real estate, franchises, collection agencies, mortgage originators, the appraisers, those appraisal management companies and franchises as the primary ones. We also thought it'd be helpful just to give you sort of flesh on the bones. Well, what is it? What have we done? What has the department done? So notable facts include that there have been on average 426 enforcement actions a year for the past 5 years. There's been about $5.7 million in fines and penalties per year, 2005, 2009. Today, the division makes more referrals to prosecutors, criminal prosecutors, than it has in the past. That's been a significant uptick, and somewhat due to the fraud unit's work that the department does. Continuing on, it assists consumers with insurance disputes. On average, it recovers approximately $4 million in additional payments for consumers yearly. Those are the phone calls that come into the department and sort of working with businesses and trying to resolve disputes. We also provide assistance and education to consumers in the disaster-struck areas, so when tornadoes hit, there's need for information. The department goes out, or it helps folks on phones and all. We have enhanced licensing services, particularly focused on increasing the speed at which the department approves things, including electronic licensing system, and at least keeping up with the industry and helping make sure that we can stay, I guess that we call it speed to market, that we're able to keep up with everything and all the changes. There's over 200,000 insurance, real estate, insurance, appraiser, financial advisors, and debt collectors licensed or registered through the department. This is to break it down. We got this question in the Commerce Committee in the Senate. Just to give you the numbers, this is 2010, beginning of 2010 to the beginning of 2011. In each of these areas or groups of licenses, and you can see how many the department is licensing in these various areas. I'll just leave the slide up so you could take a look at it. As you can see, it can be quite a significant number. It's a significant activity. Some of it's electronic, but we still have a lot of folks working in the licensing area. Another what we thought is to give you also some of the significant major matters that the department has worked on recently with some outcomes. The department helped build a case against a Lakeville real estate closer who was recently sentenced in Dakota County to 39 months in prison for the theft of more than $220,000 working as an independent closer for a title and real estate company. Also charged a real estate closer with withholding and misappropriating in excess of $1.1 million in at least 42 real estate transactions, converting the funds to her own personal use. Also levied a $250,000 fine against an insurance agent, the department accused of insurance fraud, and that person was also noted in the papers as well.
I don't mean to interrupt, but we have a question from Representative Davids.
Thank you, Mr. Hoppe, and to Commissioner. That third bullet point kind of concerns me. You levied a $250,000 fine against an insurance agent, the department accused of insurance fraud?
Mm-hmm. What was he guilty?
Mr. Munson-McGowan? Or Mr. Commissioner?
Mr. Chair.
I mean, I've been accused of a lot of things and a $250,000 a pop.
But you're guilty.
Well, that's true.
May I offer a suggestion? Perhaps some online education we could.
Mr. Chair and Representative.
The continuing ed program is very helpful to me.
Representative Davis, we've got a lot of that. I do want to call on. Mr. Munson-Regala, he has a lot of background in there. I know the case as well, but yes, it was a significant case, and there is a reason for that, and it could have been a lot more money than that. But I'll let Manny take a crack at it too.
Mr. Munson-Regala,
Chair Representative Davids, it was a consent order, so this was an inartful way of us articulating. We entered the consent order with this individual. We could have levied more, but he agreed that this was an appropriate penalty for the behavior he engaged. this was pursuant to our consent.
Mr. Chair and
Representative
and
Davis,
Assistant Commissioner, Deputy Commissioner, Deputy Commissioner. So it's kind of like he was fined, but he had no wrongdoing.
Well, Mr. Munson-Riala.
Mr. Chair, Representative Davis, I will say our consent order speaks for itself. And folks can look at the consent order. They're all posted, by the way, online. And they can see in the consent order the behavior he agrees he committed. He is not agreeing or disagreeing as to whether that those acts constitute fraud. He does concede that if we had taken this to hearing, we could have proved our case.
Okay.
So it's
thank you, Mr. Chair.
We agree.
I'm glad we got that. I saw the word accused, and I was waiting for somebody to be nervous. Please go on.
I get real nervous. These guys regulate.
The department also joined seven other lead states in a $100 million settlement with AIG for allegedly underreporting premiums. The department engages in multi-state market assurance activity, and this is just one notable example. Also fined a couple $100,000 for their part in an alleged mortgage fraud scheme, and then did an investigation involving a multi-million dollar alleged fraud by a local public official for allegedly diverting business funds to personal use. This is just some of the major areas, but there's a lot of other activity. You'll see that the current enforcement activity involves abusive practices in senior financial products, healthcare fraud, mortgage and title fraud, industry practices, and collection abuses. So that's market assurance. Turning to the other major division there's in the department is the financial institutions division. The overall program purpose or mission in this area, again, is to license and regulate state banks, credit unions, finance companies, insurance companies, and mortgage companies, to also license mortgage loan originators, check cashiers, payday lenders, money transmitters, debt management companies, and debt settlement companies. The three major goals, again, this goes back to the broad perspective, is to make sure that our job is to act in the public interest and consumer protection, but also to make sure that there's healthy competition in the marketplace for financial services with choices for Minnesota consumers and businesses, and then also to minimize and manage the financial institution failures so that there's minimal impact to customers and Minnesota. Again, as I had indicated earlier, there's really two broad areas. There's the banking and insurance solvency piece of the division. And then within the banking component, the regulated and licensed entities, this gives you a list of the number that come under our purview. There are 304 state banks, 95 state credit unions, 155 consumer credit companies, 439 mortgage companies, mortgage loan originators of 2,000, over 2,000, 79 currency exchanges, 82 money transmitters, 34 debt management companies, and 9 debt settlement companies.
Mr. Commissioner,
mm-hmm.
Can I ask a quick question about the mortgage originators? It's a rather large number, and you might not have this handy, or maybe somebody in the audience knows. Would you happen to know how many, if they're 2021 now,
yeah,
how many there were 10 years ago or 20 years ago?
Now, Mr. Chair, we can give
even
you
a ballpark. I'm just curious.
Ballpark, I'll have Deputy Commissioner Kevin Murphy come up.
Yeah. And that's Representative Mullery raised a good point. How many were there in 2006 or 2007?
Well, I generally know the answer, but I'll have
okay.
Kevin, because he's been with the department more than 8 days. But but the general notion is that with the economic, with the downturn,
right,
the recession, there's fewer now than there have been before.
Thank you. Mr. Murphy.
Mr. Chairman, Kevin Murphy, Deputy Commissioner. I guess in the broad view, there are a lot less mortgage originators now than there were several years ago. I would guess it's probably been cut in half in recent years. In the end of 2010, we launched the licensing apparatus for the mortgage industry in an entity in Washington called the National Mortgage Licensing System, and Representative Mullery carried the legislation last year. So the mortgage companies need to be licensed at the federal, at the national level, and they have to post a 100,000 charity bond. The human beings, the mortgage loan originators, have to pass a background check, a credit check, fingerprinting, pass a test, and complete some education. So we've taken quite a step in the last months in the mortgage regulation.
Thank you. So ballpark, 3 years ago, 4 years ago, there would have been 4,000 or 5,000 mortgage originators?
Mr. Chairman, until very recently, we did not license all the human beings.
Got it.
But numbers are a little bit elusive, but there are a lot less people in that business than there were a couple of years ago.
Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Murphy, or Commissioner, the kind of along the same lines, the number of banks in Minnesota, and maybe more specific than that, the number on the watch list. Yeah. I think last I checked it was 110, 111. I don't remember the exact, but is that, can you put that in perspective relative to where we were a year or two or three ago?
Mr. Commissioner.
Mr. Chair and Representative Atkins, I'll just have Deputy Commissioner Murphy stick with me for a little bit. We have slides on that, so I'm going to get to that. I don't know if it's the next one or not, but let me just, it'll be one of the next couple of slides.
Sure.
This is just a pie chart to give you, you know, a graphic that goes with that last slide. The insurance component piece, this gives you sort of the broad overview of how many domestic Minnesota companies there are, Minnesota Township Mutuals, and then foreign companies, those that are domesticated outside the state of Minnesota, that we regulate, the department regulates.
Mr. Chair. Representative Davidson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Can you go back one?
Yep.
Of the Minnesota domestic companies, life and health, how many are stock, how many are mutual, how many are fraternal, would you say? Or if you could just give me that information later, I'd like to see that.
Yeah. Sure, we can do that. We can supply that information.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Davids. Mr. Commissioner,
yeah.
Please proceed.
Again, here's a graphic of the last slide. Domestics, the township mutuals, and then the foreign companies that come into the Minnesota market. So, Mr. Chair and Representative Atkins, here's the slide I was referring to earlier. One of the major challenges as I step into the role as commissioner is to, and I have to say this, there's a terrific staff, and the department has been working with this issue for a long time, but banks and credit unions are dealing with the economic downturn. There have been 12 bank failures resolved in the past 2 years with no losses to customers. And specifically, the state bank watch list is now at 111 state banks. That's about a third of the total number, a little over a third. And then the credit union watch list is at 29.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Davis.
Mr. Chairman, Commissioner, do we have any numbers on the watch list for life insurance companies?
Mr. Commissioner or Mr. Murphy.
Let me just look a couple slides ahead.
I didn't see it.
All right, we can get that number. Mr. Chair and Representative Davis, we can get that number.
Mr. Chairman, Commissioner, I was hoping the number was zero.
Mr. Chair and Representative Davids, I don't think it's higher than zero.
Mr. Chairman, Commissioner, how about for the domestic companies? Is it zero?
Mr. Chair and Representative Davids, there are some Minnesota domestics that are relatively small companies that do have solvency concerns,
okay,
and they are on our watch list.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr.
Mr. Commissioner, if you could get Representative Davids a copy of that, I think it would be helpful. Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Davids, with enough continuing ad, that number is trending down. the question I had, though, is what's the trend line on the watch list for banks? We've had, it's 111 today, which is a nice snapshot, but my real question is, are we seeing it, or is it finally starting to trend back downwards?
Mr. Chair and Representative Atkins, we actually, two things. Let me say this. I do have the specific numbers on the insurance watch list. I can give you those numbers now. Just to let you know, there's 55 on the watch list. 12 PNC, 12 Life and Health, and 31 Township Mutuals.
Wow.
The second part of the, going to the to your question, Representative Atkins, the trend is going up, and there's consolidation. And the specific details and the numbers we have, and I'd just ask Deputy Commissioner Murphy to get the specifics to give you.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Atkins, back in 2008, we had 38 banks on the watch list, which was 12% of the total. In 2009, we had 71 banks on the watch list, which was 22% of the total. Now we're up to around 36% of the total.
And just one quick follow-up.
Representative Atkins.
Mr. Chairman, Deputy Commissioner Murphy, has the criteria remained exactly the same over the last, say, 3, 4, 5 years, or have there been adjustments that have been made that land folks on the watch list that may not have otherwise been on the watch list 2 or 3 years ago?
Mr. Murphy.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Atkins, the criteria are exactly the same.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Either of you, I know a lot of the state banks are involved with commercial, and I'm just wondering, there's a lot of recent articles nationally about the possible precipitous fall in commercial. Is that taken into account on your watch list or not?
Mr. Commissioner or Mr. Murphy?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mullery, when you speak of commercial, do you mean commercial real estate,
right,
sir?
Yeah.
Sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Murphy.
Chairman, Representative Mullery, certainly the decline in the overall economy has affected the commercial real estate industry, which has also affected financial institutions considerably.
Representative Mullery, do you have a follow-up?
It sounded like they don't have an answer exactly.
Oh, Mr.
Probably.
Mr. Chair.
And I don't know if you should have an answer. It's probably
Mr.
a difficult question.
Mr. Chair and Representative Mullery, the overall, starting generally with the overall recession and the tanking of the economy and the impact on the commercial real estate industry, it has impacted at the national bank level, and it has impacted on the smaller Minnesota chartered banks. Many of our charter banks have commercial real estate activity, and many of that commercial real estate activity involved, properties that went down in value and therefore became problems, involved schemes and scams that involved around the country that that are out there, and then transition into serious problems and maybe a significant aspect of the local bank's balance sheets problems relate to the meltdown in the commercial real estate area, and they're working on it.
Mr. Chairman, maybe I can,
Representative Mullery,
be a little more accurate. I know that it's taken into account as commercial has gone down, but there's also studies that show that there's a real possibility of a huge decline in it, and I'm just wondering if that's, look, when you're putting a watch list, do you look at the not just the decline on their books and their appraised properties or whatever, but do you also look at what could be, what the national indicators are, that there could be certain types of property really go down fast that haven't gone down yet or haven't gone down a long ways, and does that affect the watch list?
Mr. Commissioner?
Mr. Chair and Mr. Mullery, if the question is specifically to the watch list, I'm going to ask the Deputy Commissioner to take a crack at that. But generally, the banks have to be concerned about not only what the value of the real estate is, you know, in the loan portfolio, but also on their owned real estate on the balance sheet side, and whether those property values are trending down. You know, is a significant thing they have to be watchful of, and something that we would keep an eye on.
Deputy Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mullery, let me talk a little bit about how the watch list works. Watch list is developed from examination findings. We go physically do an on-site exam of banks every 12 to 18 months. We have a scoring system for banks, 1 through 5. 1 is the best, 5 is the worst, 5 is a potential failure, 3 is fair, it's not average. So the banks that end up with a score of 3, 4, and 5 go on the watch list, and that's based on examiner's assessment of the financial condition of the bank at a point in time. So we're not doing a lot of forecasting with the watch list. It's simply a way to keep score of how many banks are in what we call the challenge categories.
Representative Davids.
Mr. Chairman, to that point, of the 111, how many are threes, how many are fours, and how many are fives?
Mr. Commissioner or Mr. Deputy Commissioner?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Davids, I believe that the fours and fives are around 50, and the threes are around 60.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman. Mm-hmm.
Representative Atkins.
Just one final point. I don't mean to monopolize the conversation, but I just wanted to make a point that over the last couple of years, Friday night at 6 o'clock was one of the worst times of the week for me. And it would, and former Chair Davids and current Chair Hoppe, hopefully you'll never get that call, but it would be Mr. Murphy calling and saying we've closed a bank. It was, you know, and you think about what that means in many communities. A lot of these were little small-town banks, some of which had been around Mr. Murphy for an awful long time. Families that had lost, you know, the folks that were running those banks that had put their blood and sweat into those banks, and they virtually lost it all. The only solace that I took in that is that the customers of those banks, Mr. Murphy would start and say, all right, here's the bank. He'd talk about what the next step was. Generally, it was a merger. They'd been acquired by somebody else. And the great solace was that by 9 o'clock the following morning, they'd be open for business under a new name. And it is one of those things you don't want to be very practiced at, because it means you're having to do it a lot. But I certainly commend the department, Commissioner Wilson, Deputy Commissioner Murphy, for the way that they did that in a professional way. I never once in 2 years of getting 12 of those calls, never once heard from a customer who had anything negative to say or had any concerns about it. And I just thought it bared mentioning, even in spite of how bad it was, that the department did a fine, fine job with how they carried that out. And Representative Davids, former Chair Davids, nodding, I assume they did the same for you. So thank you very much for your efforts.
Thank you, Representative Atkins. That was well said, and I hope I don't ever get those calls. But please continue. Thank you.
Mr. Chair and Representative Atkins, if I can just pick up on that piece. As I said at the beginning, one of the primary things that's on my concern and watch list is the safety and soundness of the Minnesota Chartered Banks. I couldn't have said it better. It's seamless, and I will do everything I can to make sure that it continues that way. With that, let me turn to the next division. We have the Office of Energy Security. And within the Energy Security Office, there are several different aspects of it. There's energy regulation and planning, which advocates for Minnesota's broad public interest regarding energy resources. It also develops records and provides recommendations to the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission. In the next broad area, there's a unit or area group that does energy facilities permitting. It does not advocate for or against projects. It's a neutral in that process. It seeks to develop an environmental review record that supports prudent siting and routing of proposed projects and serves as a technical support staff to the PUC. There's also the Energy Assistance Program, and within that there are two major programs. It administers the funds appropriated to the Low-Income Home Energy Assistance Program, the LIHEAP program. We just today announced an additional allocation of $7 million. That's the fourth allocation this year. We had $143 million on the first three allocations, so the current total is $150 million. Roughly, this will get us a little bit closer to our needs, but there's still a lot of applicants out there waiting for assistance. And I should say this. I've said it to the press and everybody. If anybody asks you if they should apply or not, make sure they do. Make sure they do.
Mr. Commissioner, I apologize. We keep interrupting you. Mostly it's me. But just for the edification of the committee, the newer members, could you have somebody go over briefly what LIHEAP is and where that money comes from?
Sure. First, it's federal dollars that are allocated by the federal government that are administered through the LIHEAP program, which is housed within the Minnesota Department of Commerce. Those grant funds are then efficiently turned around and basically deposited in the accounts of folks to pay low-income folks. So we're talking about disabled, seniors, low-income people who are having a difficult time paying their utility bills. And this money goes in there immediately to help them pay and get through the hard, cold winter months, January and February, as we go through the winter.
Thank you.
In addition, the Energy Assistance Program helps eligible households meet their energy needs. That's actually the details. Next, we have with the State Energy Office, which is designated as the state recipient of the U.S. Department of Energy Formula Grant Money for the Weatherization Program. Again, those are federal dollars that go to help folks fix their homes with weatherization. That's a significant dollar figure, a significant part of the budget, but also help people, again, get through some of the difficult times in the cold months. It also oversees the mandated utility conservation improvement program, among other programs. That's the gist of it. It's very high level. After fielding the question, I'll just wrap up just sort of generally with some concluding remarks.
I know Representative Dietrich has a question. Anybody else?
Yes.
We'll start. Representative Dietrich, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Commissioner, on the Energy Assistance Program, can you give us, this is good advice. I've not been on the committee before, so this is good for me to hear. But can you give us any advice if we are to pass on to constituents how they can check to see if they qualify for assistance? Or what steps you would recommend us to give to our constituents?
Mr. Chair and Representative, why don't I have our staff give you those eligibility requirements? We have that information, and they can just shoot it right to you.
That would be wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Commissioner. And then I don't see any other questions. Oh, sorry, Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to quickly ask, what kind of efforts do you do to help businesses comply and make sure that they're doing the right thing so they don't come into a situation where they're fined later on?
Mr. Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I guess it would vary. It would depend. But when when all, you know, the businesses are relatively sophisticated. We're talking about major insurance companies, major banks, as well as smaller banks in insurance, as well as we have all of the licensees. The department does its best to on continuing education, making sure folks are up to speed on those requirements. Whenever there are, you know, examinations or things of that nature that we have to do, we work with the companies. And then as far as offering assistance, our, you know, we're, the lines are always open. My office is always open, and I know we get a lot of calls. And even when I was outside of the department in my prior life, pick up the phone and help companies come into compliance or clarify what is compliance. You just pick up the phone, and we can help folks navigate those questions.
Representative Davidson.
Well, Mr. Chairman, thank you. And I'd also echo what former Chair Atkins said. That was a, remember one time we were out in the Rocky Mountains someplace and the call came in, and that's just, it's not a lot of fun. It's not a lot of fun, but the department has, from what I've seen, taken care of that very professionally and done a very good job. That being said, I would also just like to say to the commissioner, you know, this state is very fortunate and very blessed to have the financial institutions we have. And the role of the department, I think, has been very good over the last years in that if there's some bad actors, if there's some folks that shouldn't be, I mean, all you got to do is accuse them and we can fine them $250,000. But we don't want the bad ones. But we've got some major domicile companies in the state that are doing the right thing, doing some very, very good things. And it's of course, your role to make sure that they are on the up and up, and I think you do a very good job at it.
Thank you, Representative Davids. Any other questions, members? With that, if you wanted to wrap up, Mr. Commissioner, or if you're done, we appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to thank you again, and we're willing to help, and it's a collaborative process. And again, as I make the rounds and talk to people, I look forward to meeting everybody in a one-on-one capacity. So thank you very much for the time today.
Thank you. You're always welcome. Thank you, Deputy Commissioner Murphy. Thank you. With that, we will move to the second part of today's agenda. We're going to have an overview of, make sure I get this right, the Minnesota Council of Health Plans, and we're going to go over health insurance broadly in Minnesota. Do we need, Dan, are you doing technical? It's great to have a technical wizard here. Thanks, Dan.
It is great. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. My name is Catherine Kmit, and I am the Director of Policy and Government Affairs for the Minnesota Council of Health Plans. The Council of Health Plans is a trade association that represents seven nonprofit health plans here in Minnesota. So our members are a lot of names you've probably heard of in the past, and maybe a few that you are not so familiar with. But they include large companies like Blue Cross, Health Partners Medica, Metropolitan Health Plan, and UCare Minnesota are both health plans that serve only government programs. And then we also have Preferred One and Sanford Health Plan as part of our membership. The health plans provide coverage to more than 4.3 million people here in Minnesota, and spent nearly $17 billion on health care in 2009. They employ roughly 16,000 people across the state, and they are regulated as nonprofit health care organizations licensed under several chapters and statutes, 62A, 62C, and 62D. One of the distinctions about nonprofit health plans is that unlike for-profit plans, they are for-profit plans, which are beholden to shareholders, nonprofit health plans use revenues to reinvest in programs and services to improve the health of Minnesotans. So just to give you a little bit of a historical perspective, most countries, most industrialized countries have a socialized system where coverage is provided as a government benefit. But here in the United States, we followed a different path, really as a result of wage freezes during World War II. This led some employers to start offering health care benefits as a way to attract employees. And after World War II, employers competed for employees with benefits. So that's kind of how our accidental system came about. So this might seem like a dumb question for this committee, but why have insurance? And I think that it's actually good to go back and revisit this. The real reason for having insurance is to protect against the risk of financial loss due to illness or injury. It's also to spread the risk, and we have found that people with health insurance are more likely to seek care earlier when it's easier to treat their condition. The thing about insurance, and especially health insurance, is that most of us are generally healthy most of the time, but sooner or later, almost all of us will need extensive and expensive health care. The purpose of health insurance is to pool as many people together to spread or share the costs generated by a small number of people. And over the long run, risk pooling makes sense because everybody, almost everybody, eventually needs expensive health care. It's much more manageable to pay an average amount or premium every month than to get hit all at once by medical bills that can reach tens or hundreds of thousands of dollars. And in any given year in Minnesota, just 1% of the population accounts for almost 25% of all health care spending in the United States. The sickest 5% of people account for about 50% of total spending, but in contrast, the healthiest 50% of the population accounts for just 3% of total spending. So what's the difference between managed care, which is the type of companies that I represent, versus traditional fee-for-service? With traditional fee-for-service health insurance, an individual goes to the physician or another medical provider, and the provider bills you, and you then submit a claim to your insurance company for reimbursement. In addition to your insurance premium, you pay an annual deductible. That's the kind of insurance that I had when I first started out about 30 years ago. It was a major medical, and it didn't cover things like preventive care and first dollar coverage for screenings and things like that. That's about the time that managed care really kind of came into its own, really through the advent of HMOs or health maintenance organizations. And one of the values of or benefits of HMOs is that through managing the care, we've created a system that includes provider networks that are made up of credentialed providers who provide additional value-added services. Furthermore, health plans are able to obtain provider discounts in the marketplace through their negotiating ability. So let's talk a little bit about the state government's role. There really are three roles that are played by state governments. The first, of course, is the regulator, and you heard a lot about what the Department of Commerce does. But in addition to the Department of Commerce, the health plans are also regulated by the Departments of Health as well as the Department of Human Services. So the Department of Health oversees quality standards and for the HMOs, and the Department of Commerce ensures solvency. So they are focused on making sure that the health plans have enough money to be able to pay the claims. And the Department of Human Services contracts with the health plans to cover people who are covered by state public programs. The state also plays a role as a purchaser of coverage through their state employee health plan, the CGIP plan, as well as I just mentioned, through DHS for Minnesota health care programs such as Medicaid, Minnesota Care, et cetera. And then finally, state government has a role as a policymaker where, and I think that's really your role, where the state reviews and sets policy direction as well as tries to balance the ever-increasing demand for services against limited health care resources. So Under regulation of health insurance, really the purpose, as I mentioned, is to ensure solvency, to make sure that there are enough dollars in place so that the claims can be paid, people can continue to get care, and providers can continue to provide care. It's also the purpose of regulation is to make sure that the risk spreading and risk selection is appropriate, and there are different rules for different types or different types of purchasers, small employers, individuals, large employers, and that's all overseen by primarily the Department of Commerce, but to make sure that we're following the rules. So as I mentioned, the government has several roles as a primary regulator, and the state really regulates the health insurance industry here in Minnesota. The health insurance industry is not regulated by the federal government, or very little is regulated by the federal government. So the rules will vary state to state. The federal government sets some basic national rules, but for the most part, our state agencies are the chief regulator of the health plans. So in talking about private commercial coverage, there are really two types. An employer-sponsored group coverage, and that's how most of us get our insurance, is through our employer, which is really wonderful in a lot of ways, but it also sort of keeps the consumer a bit disconnected from the whole process of what's involved with health insurance, how does it work, how much does it cost, how much is my portion of the cost, and that sort of thing. So I know that when I talk to colleagues or legislators, other people, they are often unfamiliar with how health insurance through your employer actually works. So typically your employer purchases it for the employees. It's often very comprehensive, but not always. They may make some changes in order to make it more affordable. And we'll talk a little bit about what happens with self-funded products. In the fully insured market, the market that is regulated by the Department of Commerce and Departments of Health, is there are health plans are required to provide as many as 64 different mandated benefits, and the premiums and enrollee cost sharing can vary, but it is regulated in statute and in rule. So there's one kind of coverage, that's employer-sponsored group coverage, as well as then there's individual coverage, which is typically purchased by individuals, and those products tend to have much higher deductibles, and things like age and health status are still determining factors for those products, but only through 2014. In talking a little bit more about group products and individual products, as I mentioned, the employer-sponsored coverage is often quite comprehensive, although there can be variation in benefits. Individual policies are typically less comprehensive. There are options for individuals who choose to purchase a product, to be able to purchase that product without coverage for maternity or chemical dependency, even prescription drugs. That helps to drive down the cost of that premium. They typically often have higher deductibles as well. So I'm going to talk a little bit about ERISA, which is a federal law. It stands for the Employee Retirement Income Security Act of 1974. And this is a law that was initially enacted as a pension law, but has evolved over time and had more jurisdiction over employee benefits. And what's unique about ERISA is that ERISA offers to large employers the opportunity to purchase or to set up their own health insurance benefit system for their employees. But by doing that, they do not have to be subject to state regulation. So, for example, a large company, for example, like a 3M that may have employees in 50 different states, rather than having to follow the various state laws across all 50 states, they choose to self-insure. They actually have enough resources within their organization to be able to set aside enough money to be able to pay the claims of their own employees. What they don't do is they may not have the expertise to process claims or to develop a network of providers and that sort of thing. So instead, they will contract with a health plan to administer those benefits for them. That's another nuance that is sometimes lost on employees working for a larger corporation, not realizing that actually I have a card that says a specific health plan company, however, I'm really covered by a self-funded plan, my employer, and as such, my coverage is not subject to state regulation or state requirements. So one of the benefits of self-insuring is that the employer is able to realize some tax and regulatory advantages, mm-hmm. and it does make it a little bit more cost-effective for them. But it's typically something that a large employer does because they are the only ones who have the resources to be able to do that. I'm just giving you a little snapshot here of to depict or illustrate what we were just talking about. So these are the taxes and assessments that small employers and self-employed individuals would pay under an HMO product. It's in the neighborhood of roughly 6.6%. For an indemnity product, a regular insurance company product, it's closer to a little over 7%. But you can see that the tax advantages are really pretty remarkable.
Ms. Quick, and I hate to ask you to do this, can you sort of skip or maybe hit highlights?
You bet.
I know we have a couple of questions already, and I want to make sure we have time for all the questions at the end.
I will do that.
Thank you.
I'm going to skip this one because this is really not something that we're going to focus on Medicare. I'll just mention a little bit about Medicaid, and that is that the state uses the health plans. It's a requirement in statute that the Minnesota HMOs are required to participate in state public programs, and DHS contracts with the health plans and requires them to provide a wide range of administrative services and develop and contract with providers to deliver services. And I'm happy to talk more about this if people have questions. Just to give you a quick comparison here, of where Minnesota used to be back in 1993, how Minnesotans got their coverage. And you can see this top line that says self-funded employer coverage. Back in 1993, only 29% of the population was covered by the self-funded market. By 2008, that had really grown to 40%. And then underneath it, you can see fully insured coverage was at 39% in 1993, but then had dropped considerably to 26%. So there's been a real turnover, and that means that when you are considering benefit mandates or other laws that will regulate the fully insured market, those changes or laws or benefit mandates will only affect really roughly 26% of the marketplace, because that's really only the jurisdiction over which you have control in the private market. So again, just another picture. This is from the Department of Health, a picture of where Minnesotans get their coverage as of last year. Nearly 60% of Minnesotans get it through their employer, 5% individual, almost 29% through public programs, and we have an uninsured rate of 9.1%. So our status, again, is we're still one of the lowest rates of uninsured, but it has gone up in recent years. And I will just point out that between 2004 and 2009, more than 82,000 people lost small group coverage. And the drop in 2009 was over 42,000 alone. So the cost of care, which translates into higher premiums, has affected employers' ability to pay for coverage for their employees. I'm sure the economy has not helped with that either. Minnesota's health plans offer an array of products. I'm just going to skip over this one. They try to provide as much choice and variability in the market for purchasers. Again, we've talked a little bit about this. What does health insurance cost? And it depends. It depends on who's covered, what age and health status they have, what they're covering, what the underlying health care costs are, what the underlying medical inflation is, and then how much does it cost to actually run the company to provide these products. just to give you a snapshot of where Minnesota's healthcare dollar goes, total healthcare spending, that's not just my health plans, but total healthcare spending in the state, in 2008 was about $35 billion. So you can see how it's carved up 21, almost 22% for physicians and hospital care at 32.6%. Those are really the biggest chunks of the pie, and then you can see how that goes down from there. This is a picture of how a pie chart of how the premium dollar is spent. This is just where my members, how the health plans divide up the premium dollar. Most of it is through physician services, inpatient hospital, outpatient, some other services, and then about 9.4% is paid through, is devoted to administrative expenses and taxes. So just to tell you a little bit about admin costs, because you might hear about this, for every dollar in premium revenue, about 9 cents is used for admin costs. 20% of that 9 cents pays for customer service, detection and fraud prevention, health education, disease management, quality assurance, etc. 27% of that 9 cents pays for taxes and assessments, and about 50% of that 9 cents pays for billing, enrollment, claims processing, research, underwriting, etc. So just to wrap up, we have a success story to tell here in Minnesota. We are one of the healthiest states in the nation. We still have a low rate of uninsured, although that rate has creeped up. We offer generous benefits as required by statute, and we are most of the state gets their health care coverage through nonprofit, locally based, community-driven organizations. We still have some challenges, however. We have, like I said, a growing number of uninsured. Rising health care costs equals rising premiums. Health care taxes contributes more and more to the cost of the premiums, and the direction of moving more towards self-funded coverage does put more pressure on the fully insured market, and we continue to need to do more and do better around health disparities. So with that, I have some contact information. I'd be happy to answer any questions now or in the future.
I think we do have some questions now. Representative Dietrich, did you have a question?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. This was interesting to me. And as I started looking at these slides and the message kind of seemed to continue even as the presentation went on, but it seems like on slide 10 when we were talking about the employer-sponsored coverage versus individually purchased policies and the incentives or the advantages for large employers to be able to provide products for the employees. I started once again thinking about what about the small employers? They don't get that advantage of scale. They are just in from so many different vantage points at a disadvantage. And then when you went further in the slides on 17, it seems like it might be the small employers that are having the most difficult time maintaining health insurance for their employees, and it puts them at such a competitive disadvantage. And I don't feel like that's a competitive disadvantage that we can have in this state, because our small businesses are really a big part of the Minnesota economy, and if we're looking to improve it. So anyhow, could you just tell me a little bit about what you know about what we have done or what your organization and the people that you represent have done in order to help find solutions for the small business community in terms of health care?
Sure.
Ms. Komet.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Dietrich. Yes, one of the reasons why health insurance coverage is more expensive for a smaller employer is because they can't afford to self-fund. They have to pay a premium and transfer that risk to the insurance company or to the health plan. Mm-hmm. They don't have the resources themselves. If they were able to self-fund, they would be able to avoid paying the health care taxes, for example, that are imposed by the state, or certain mandated benefits or other requirements that the state imposes on the small group market. And so you're right, they are at a competitive disadvantage because they don't have that kind of flexibility. Now, in the past few years, there have been a couple of laws that have been passed to provide more flexibility for a small employer. it's difficult. There are some options out there where smaller employers can choose to purchase coverage without mandated benefits, but at one point we tried to do that, and the Attorney General came in, or a law had been passed to do that, and the Attorney General came in and said, you can't do that. You have to provide coverage for maternity and mental health coverage. So, and typically those are the more, oftentimes the more expensive types of coverages that make up the cost of the premium. So it's a challenge. It's really difficult because we don't want people dropping insurance. We want as many people to be in the pool and have that protection for them. So it's a real challenge.
Thank you. Follow-up, Representative Dietrich.
Yes, thank you. So maybe you can just give me an overview then. I know there has been a lot of talk in the past of small businesses pooling together, and what are the obstacles to that, and why has that not been successful in the past?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Dietrich, the idea of pooling is important because the bigger the pool, the more stable the pool is, and when there's a large claim or something like that, it can be handled more easily because there's such a large pool. Well, that's what the health plans do. They pool those resources. So, in effect, you've got health plans that already have these very large pools in place. For small employers, I think it would be difficult for them to get to the size and the breadth and scope of a pool that would really serve to stabilize their risk and to manage their claims volatility. It's really, that's the function that the health plan or the insurance company provides for them. So I think what we've seen happen in other states is a bunch of employers will get together, they'll all pool some resources together, and then when there are a few high claims that get submitted to the pool and they get paid out, other employers realize, wait a minute, this is too expensive, we don't want to be in it anymore, and so the healthy risk jumps out of the pool, leaving only the sick risk in the pool. And so as they use more resources, those costs go up and it gets more expensive for those remaining in the pool. That's the challenge, and that's why it's much better to have as big of a pool as possible.
Thank you. Representative Stensrud.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just have a question to clarify on. You have a chart on 15. I'm just wondering, where Minnesota's get coverage for the small business owner, maybe an LLC, where they're sort of a self-funded employer plan. If they have an HSA and their own private insurance, where are they on this chart? Are they fully insured coverage?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Stensrud, I would say that most small employers typically are covered under with a fully insured product. It's possible, though, that and the agents are going to come up and talk after me, and they would probably have even more information about the kinds of employers or customers that they see who may try to self-insure. But it's really, I think there's a sort of a sweet spot, if you will, where an employer with fewer than 100 employees really probably shouldn't try to self-fund.
Right. But
just Representative Stensrud.
But if they're buying their own insurance, then they're under this 26% in 2008, the fully insured coverage, because they have a private plan that they bought themselves.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Stensrud, so you're saying if they're buy an individual product for themselves?
Right.
Yes, they would be covered as a fully insured product.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Loon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And actually, a lot of the question line I was going down have been covered by Representative Dietrich and Representative Stensrud, but just maybe a slight follow-up to what Ms. Schmidt was talking about, and I have some familiarity with the notion of flexible benefits plans for small employers, and it was the intention of the legislature, I think it was 2005 when we first went down that road, and actually we did a little more work on it last year to expand that pool. It sounds like some action by the Attorney General has had a fairly chilling effect on that working as we had hoped intended, that health plans would be coming forward or working with small businesses to try to develop some plans that would be affordable so small employers could offer something to their employees, maybe if it didn't have all 64 mandates that Minnesota requires. I mean, is that pretty much just stopped any development of alternative products in the marketplace, or is there some discussions going on?
Ms. Kmet.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Loon, the chilling effect that you're talking about did happen after 2005 or thereabouts, but since that time, several of the health plans have come forward with products to meet the that meet the requirements of the flexible benefits plan, and so I'm not completely familiar with all those products, but I know that there are products on the marketplace that that do that, that offer that.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Loon.
Thank you. Ms. Kmet, would you have any statistics on how many small businesses are utilize that flexibility and are obtaining those products?
Ms. Kmet.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Loon, I don't know the answer off the top of my head, but I will check on that and get that to you.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Any other questions? If not, we can bring Mr. Tyler down and continue our agenda. Thank you, Ms. Kinnett. Whenever you guys are ready, we're ready for you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is John Tyler. I'm with Boies & Tyler Financial Group, as well as a representative of the Minnesota Association of Health Underwriters, representing four coalitions of agents that we'll talk initially about off of a couple of handouts I think you might have in your materials, and I'll just speak initially about the role of the insurance agent in the process of offering insurance. And the health insurance agent is an individual who oftentimes has one boot in a multiple camps. You know, it might be the retirement type of community as far as Medicare supplement types of plans. It might be individual policies. It might be small employers. It might be mid-size or large employers, or really all of the above. Our business agency is, I think, probably would qualify as far as all of the above is concerned. We actually are involved with insuring 2.4 million Minnesotans overall. And we interact with them with regard to what their needs overall might be as far as an individual is concerned, trying to match with them whatever it might. It's not working. Okay. What their personal needs might be, whether it's a more elaborate plan, more basic plan, HSA plan, or what have you. More involved, though, is stepping into the world of the employee benefits arena. And we actually do more than just place health insurance there. We actually are involved with interactions of government rules and regulations, both at the state level and oftentimes at the federal level as well. We interact with the insurance companies and having a good, solid understanding of what is available with regard to every insurance company that we market. So properly communicating, we have an obligation to properly communicate what the products are, as well as try to make the match here. This is going to be insurance. Okay. All right. There
we were showing you pictures.
What kind of pictures were those?
you look good, John.
Okay. All right. Essentially, our role is to, as our clients, group clients, or business clients often say, is to really keep them out of jail and keep them in compliance with all the rules and regulations that are there. There are many different types of plans, from COBRA continuation plans, Section 125 plans, I might know whatever HRA plans, HSA plans, and so forth. So, keeping our clients basically compliant in all categories is really, really important. With that, also, there's a piece here that I'm really not going to go through, but I would direct your attention to, is a lot of myths and misconceptions about health insurance. And one of the things that I think is not understood is really the role that insurance actually plays. And I think because of the lack of understanding of health insurance in general, there are a lot, it's very easy to make a lot of assertions that really oftentimes we find aren't true. One of the things I would like to just comment on, be the fourth one down, talks about insurance companies have regularly rescinded coverage when individuals fall ill, especially in the individual marketplace. And very candidly, that's just not true. I mean, it's our our esteemed commissioners would escort the insurance company out of the state if they ever tried to do something like that. So that's been the case, you know, ever since I think individual health insurances have been in the marketplace. So the federal government did not come to the rescue as far as that's concerned. That's always been the case, as far as that, you know, that's concerned. One of the things I'll just comment on about the underwriting process, and Chris Sheeman and my colleague will be talking about that process in more detail in just a minute. But the health screening process is oftentimes, you know, criticized about the process of determining risk or addressing risk as far as the risk pools are concerned. And essentially, the underwriting process, is their responsibility is to keep those risk pools solvent, so when claims are submitted, they're paid. It's a very, very important process that's very, very not well understood at all. And another thing I'd just like to point out is that in Minnesota, since 1976, we have had our version, the Minnesota version of guaranteed issue as far as health insurance is concerned, through the Minnesota Comprehensive Health Association. So anyone tells you that they couldn't get insurance in Minnesota because of a pre-existing condition, they just haven't been informed properly of what's available in the state of Minnesota. So the MCHA, or the Minnesota Comprehensive Health Association, that's the last one on the first page, has been around since 1976. And so anyone is declined for standard issue coverage, they have a free ticket into the MCHA. And those rates are regulated, by law. They can't be more than 25% higher than standard issue as far as those premiums are concerned. It's currently administered by Medica. And so those are just a couple of comments I'd like to offer myths and misconceptions here as well. The other things that are there about how inefficient health insurance is, and private health insurance is, on the contrary, it's much more efficient, administratively speaking, than anything that might be available in the public sector at all. And so with that, we'll just defer to Chris Schneeman and to talk about the PowerPoint slide that you have here in your slides as well.
Thank you, Mr. Cutter. And could you identify yourself for the record and please proceed?
Certainly, Chairman. My name is Chris Schneeman. I am an independent employee benefit health insurance agent here in the city of St. Paul. Been licensed since 1978. I currently serve about 200 small employers and several thousand individuals who purchase health insurance through our agency. So thank you very much for allowing this time to talk a little bit about our agent's role and to perhaps give you a little insight into our world. So our topic continues to be the overview of private health care coverage and to a degree how distribution works in Minnesota. John touched on this, and I think it's interesting that Catherine Commit mentioned a minute ago that there are about 4.3 million people insured. 2.4 are influenced or by their insurance through some sort of advisory arrangement with an agent. Approximately 80% of employers use an advisor to make those decisions. We are also here representing one of our professional associations that operates here in the state of Minnesota called the Minnesota Association of Health Underwriters. And these are licensed professionals in the state who provide insurance products to the majority of Minnesotans through privately owned and employer-sponsored insurance. And I will move on because I know we're on a schedule here, right? There's also a coalition. I'll just mention what this is because this is an organization that was created in the early 1980s as Minnesota Care and some of that early legislation was coming through the legislature. And it's called the Agents Coalition of Healthcare Reform, and it really is a representation to kind of give a common voice on health issues from these four prominent associations. One is the association I mentioned just a minute ago, the Minnesota Association of Health Underwriters. The other is the National Association of Insurance and Financial Advisors, also known as NAFA Minnesota. The other is the Minnesota Independent Insurance Agents and Brokers, or MIIAB. Sometimes it's referred to as the Big I, if you recall that name. And also the Professional Insurance Agents here in Minnesota. So rather than have four organizations come to you, we've kind of coalesced around a single voice on these health-related issues. So how does the market work? In general, we have healthcare consumers, people who buy care. We have providers like doctors and hospitals who provide that care. And if that's all we had, nothing else would be needed, as long as the price were affordable. But as we all know, health care can be an extremely expensive adventure. So what we do is we pool. We create a resource for people to collaborate together so that if there are unexpected or even expected medical costs, that there'll be some financing available for that particular individual. You know, in a simple sense, we call that insurance. But we have insurance companies to be able to run this, right? And this is the mechanism of which we use to pool money to pay these medical claims. Folks are obligated, the insurance companies are obligated under their contract with their members to pay claims for these large claims. But their primary purpose, and you'll find it in many of their charters, is that they have to remain solvent and they have to be out there for the protection of their members, their insureds. Okay? And in fact, we heard a nice presentation from the Department of Commerce, and you may have, in the through the dialogue, you may have picked up, is that one of their core functions is to make sure that these companies are solvent. Right? That's an important ingredient in providing that consumer protection that they were talking about. So its solvency is a big issue for the carrier. Ultimately, the individual transfers this risk to the insurance company for the large unexpected claims, and that premium that you pay is your price for admission for that protection. Okay. Right now, we're looking at total premiums that are collected by the insurance companies really go out to pay for the cost of care. The statistic that we'll see here is 7.9% is to actually operate and provide margin for those carriers, make sure that their reserves are sufficient, and that 92.7% actually goes out in payment of claims. Now, we could ask our Department of Commerce to audit those numbers for us, and I'm sure they would be glad to do that, right? And another fun fact is that in this past year, according to Milliman and Company, that the increases in the cost of care have been primarily driven by the increase in unit price for care rather than patient utilization. This is a little bit different than what we've seen in years past, in that people were getting more and more care as opposed to just getting more expensive care, right? The combination of those two really make up medical inflation, but we're starting to see a mitigation of the actual utilization rate as the lead chief driver of the cost of care. So what we're looking for ultimately with healthcare and a lot of the conversations is about make it predictable. So we ask that the carriers provide some stability for the price of our premiums and also the fact that we're going to have some security if we run those fake claims. The process that they go through to protect that pool is underwriting. It's evaluating the risk of somebody saying, I want in to this pool here. Okay? So I'm going to move on from underwriting a little bit into the four general characteristics of how an employer is categorized for these pools, insurance pools. The first is the small employer. In Minnesota, in 1992, we started protecting small employers with the small group insurance laws. At that time, all insurance companies are offering insurance to a small employer defined at the time of 2 to 29 employees, was required to issue that small employer insurance. They could not decline them. They couldn't say, you've got a bad risk in your group, we don't want you. As of 1992, in Minnesota, small employers were guaranteed access to the insurance market. Since then, that definition of a small employer has grown to 50 employees. So now we think in terms of small employers as less than 50, which means large employers are going to be 50 or more, right? Some of those employers are fully insured, and they tend to be on the smaller end of that spectrum. Some of those employers feel that they're capable of taking on some additional risk, and they can become self-insured. And I think Catherine Kmit explained some of the integral differences between that. But back to the myths that John was mentioning just a second ago. The myth is that a small employer pays more for their care than a large employer. True or false? Not true. A small employer will pay the exact same amount of money for their care as a large employer will, right? They may pay a little more for their premium because they've got to pay taxes and they've got a different administrative load, but the cost of care is not influenced by the size of the employer that you work for. For example, if you have a heart bypass and you go to United Hospital in downtown St. Paul, they do not bill you based on if you work at 3M or if you work for Joe's B. The price of your bypass is going to be the same, and since claims drive 92% of the cost of that premium, you'll find that ultimately that small employer is paying for the same price of care. The other statistic, and I think over the course of your work here on the Commerce Committee, you'll probably hear from the Department of Commerce's statistician, a gentleman named Stefan, starts with a G. I think you folks probably know him. The statistics that you'll see coming out of their office is that small employers actually have a lower premium paid per employee than large employers do. Right? So there's another myth out there for you just to be aware of. Right? Now that sounds counterintuitive, doesn't it? And the reason why, ultimately, is number one, they get the care for the same price as a large employer, but a small employer tends to be a little bit more adept at buying their insurance with higher deductibles, higher out-of-pocket exposures, right? They've tended to embrace the idea of an HSA a little bit faster than a large employer. Less likely to be unionized, right? Less likely to offer a $15 copay. Consequently, their premium costs are going to be lower than a larger employer. So those are just some things that since this is an educational session, that might be important for you to be aware of. Okay? Each carrier does pool all of their small employers into one pool. Another fun fact for everybody, the largest pool in the state of Minnesota right now is actually Blue Cross Blue Shield's individual policy pool, right? It's about 40,000 participants in that pool, and everybody in the pool, once they get in, pays the same rate based on their age. So if their health changes after they've been admitted to their pool, it does not affect their premiums, so they get that stability there. So we've done that with small employers, pooling them all together from 2 to 50. These policies are guaranteed issue, and there's something called a HIPAA pre-existing condition protection, which I think I want to spend just a second explaining. The HIPAA federal laws came along and they said that if a person remains continuously insured, if they switch from one job to the next, then the new plan has to recognize the amount of service that they've had in their old employer's plan, right? Consequently, they're not allowed to apply a new limitation on benefits due to a pre-existing condition. This released people from their job lock that we used to talk about years ago. I can't quit my job because my insurance won't be good at my new place. So this HIPAA portability allowed persons a lot more flexibility in moving from job to job without having to sacrifice their coverage. However, if a person does go uninsured, they would be subject to a limitation of benefits for those conditions they had before. Okay, so if somebody tries to hop in and out of the insurance world, they could suffer a fairly significant consequence for not having coverage for something that they were treated for trying to buy insurance. And yes,
Mr. Schieman, I know you've already said that you're hurrying through things, and we appreciate that, but I just want to make you aware of the clock, and if I don't get everybody out of here at 4:15, they'll come back with a rope. So. Okay. I'm just looking out for me personally. Okay. But if you could jump through and hit highlights, and I apologize for running short of time, but we would appreciate it.
Very good. And I think that some of these middle slides here have been touched
He's
on.
He's going to get a rope event. Right now.
Uh-oh.
Thank you.
We did touch on these in some of the earlier proposals or discussion. So, and I'll skip through the Minnesota Comprehensive Health Program. There's the assessment that's only paid by fully insured persons in the state. And the risk pools, right? So ultimately, what we've got is four pools that we're dealing with here and that provide health insurance. Furthest to the left, you'll see your individual policy holders. Those are our lowest premiums right now. Many of you may be aware that if you're paying your own premium, you tend to buy higher deductibles. If your employer pays the premium, you want full coverage, right? That plays out in the types of products that people buy in the marketplace. If somebody is uninsurable, then they can purchase coverage through the MCHA program that's been discussed. And then on the employer side, it's either going to be fully insured or self-insured, depending on how much risk that employer is willing to take. Okay, a health insurance agent is really the. I'm going to put each of these slides up. Oops, I went too far. Reacts to the marketplace in a couple of different ways, and we react to the type of buyer that comes to us. There's two types of buyers. people who want to get insurance. There's some that come and they want to buy, right? Effectively, they are interested in getting insured as quickly as they can. However, most people have to be sold insurance. Nobody likes to pay premiums. It's just kind of a fact of our human nature, right? So one of the important roles of the job or roles of the agent is to sell the insurance and keep people covered throughout. Make sure they understand the consequences of not being covered. So it's an important function that we have to keep in consideration. Now, those who want to buy coverage, they tend to call us, and they say, I've got a need for insurance. They need to get that policy issued as quick as possible, right, because they have an expectation that they may have a claim, right? We all know those folks. The house is on fire. We want to buy it right now, okay? And they tend to be high-risk people. The people that we really need to have in the pools, in the insurance pools, are the folks that, by and large, don't have claims or don't expect them. Sometimes we call them zeros because they have zero claims, right? They have to be sold coverage, right? And so the role of the agents is to make sure that those healthy people buy into the plan. This is going to be an issue that becomes very important as we start looking at a guarantee issue health insurance rule that's being offered to us by the Affordable Care Act in 2014. Okay, so we have to attract them. We got to keep them in. The agent, by the way, has a financial incentive to keep people in these pools because if somebody drops their insurance, agent doesn't get paid anymore. It's really that simple. Okay? And without that, the pools suffer adverse selection, and they start to have higher premiums and ultimately fail. Okay, and I think those were our major points. I think we're open for questions.
Thank you very much. And again, I appreciate your willingness to speed things up a little. It is an important topic, and we appreciate you being here. Any questions, members? Representative Lilly, question? You don't have to ask a question. I thought you were sitting for
Mr. Chair, I'll pass.
Thank you, Representative. Any other questions? With that, Mr. Tyler.
I don't have a question, Mr. Chair. I just want to just make a comment that this basic foundation, I think, is relevant because we will be bringing forward a number of bills that will be based on a lot of the principles that we talked about here, both Catherine and ourselves as well, in future presentations.
We appreciate that.
All right, thank you.
Thank you very much. And with that, members, we are adjourned.